Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we will be chatting with two of the organisers of an event that was held here in Australia last year. It's called PlatypusCon. As you'll hear, it wasn't really a typical security con. Attendees had to bring laptops and had to participate. The whole thing was centered around workshops, and everybody I know who went said it was brilliant. And I personally think this is an idea that's going to catch on outside of Australia. So we'll be speaking with Snail and Lynn S. About that one in this week's feature interview. This week's show is brought to you by Vericode. Big thanks to them. And in this week's sponsor interview, we'll check in with Vericode's Senior Product Innovation Manager, Colin Dominey, about a couple of things. Vericode did a pretty interesting survey recently that shows that developers are, in fact, finally becoming security aware in a pretty major way. Not only that, but Vericode has made some pretty significant changes to its products. Well, they've released a new product to reflect this switch. Static analysis software security tools are becoming something the developers themselves use. They're not just for the security team these days. So we will talk about the rationale behind Vericode's recent release of a scanner that plugs directly into IDEs. But before we get into all of that, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, last week we mentioned that the NSA contractor Hal Martin was about to be charged for all of the stuff he walked across the air gap. He has indeed been charged.
Yep, they're charging him with all sorts of things. At least the range of documents and range of information that they are asserting that he took going back, decades.
20 years, right?
Yeah. It's quite a big list. And across a broad range of bits of the government as well. I mean, not just the NSA. They're also saying that he had docs from the DOD, from US Cyber Command, from the National Reconnaissance Office about spy satellites, as well as the CIA. And I guess, that's perhaps because of the way the kind of contractor outsourced stuff works, maybe because of the information sharing, or maybe he got moved around. I don't know. But yeah, it's they seem to be throwing quite a large list of things at him. And of course, the list of documents and information that he is that they're using in the court filings, I guess, or in the charges against him, is sort of representative, and one assumes doesn't include the extra juicy stuff they don't want you to know that he nicked. But yeah, it just does not look good for him at all.
No, it really doesn't. And there's a part of me that kind of feels sorry for the guy. You know what I mean? Because he seems to be mostly guilty of being really dumb. Well, do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like he was sneaking this shit out to, jump over the Mexican border and, sell it to the Russians in their embassy or something. Like, the guy was just engaged in a bit of, unauthorized offsite backup by the looks of things,
Well, and you can kind of understand in a way, you don't want to necessarily lose access to that kind of information. I think it's once you get access to that kind of thing, the idea of not having it, I guess, must be kind of scary if you're that way inclined. Mm. I don't know. I can kind of imagine that, but he's going to have a bad time, and
he really is, man. He's going to prison for being stupid. You know what I mean? Like, and that's kind of why I feel a bit sorry for him. But hard to say that he doesn't actually deserve it a little bit,
Well, kind of, yeah. Like, you shouldn't take your, if you work at the NSA and TAO, maybe you shouldn't take your work home.
But. Yeah, maybe that's a... Maybe that's some good advice there. Oh, now a big shit fight this week between CrowdStrike and NSS Labs. And, it's a funny one, this. Let's get into it, Adam. Tell us, first of all, what actually happened.
Right. So CrowdStrike, amongst other things, makes their kind of Falcon endpoint security software product thing. NSS Labs, if you're not familiar with them, do sort of nominally independent testing and certification of security products, and typically firewalls, IDS, antivirus products. And it's meant to be a sort of consumer advice kind of thing where they rate them and compare and contrast. So CrowdStrike initially paid NSS to do some testing of their products for the purposes of evaluation, decided they didn't like NSS's methodologies, which, as we will discuss, is entirely reasonable. And then NSS decided that they were going to test it anyway and release the results at RSAcon, and that the results aren't very good. And they purchased a copy of CrowdStrike Falcon through a reseller, and now CrowdStrike is attempting to sort of injunct against them publishing their results, alleging all sorts of, breach of contract or breaching the terms and conditions, acceptable use policy that you click through when you install the product or whatever. And the court has actually said nope to that.
So, yes. But this is kind of derp on derp, and it's really funny watching CrowdStrike complain about misappropriation of intellectual property, considering one of its founders, George Kurtz, was also one of the founders at Foundstone, which, if you recall, was at the center of quite a serious scandal involving large amounts of pirated software, Adam. Do you remember that?
That was a long time ago, but yes, I had actually forgotten that.
There you go. We have long memories at risky.biz. We do. but, you know, this isn't the first time people have had a bit of a bitch and moan about NSS Labs. And, you know, if you've been in the industry long enough, you can kind of see that the bitching and moaning has a point.
Yeah, certainly if you talk to anyone who's an engineer at an IDS company or an engineer on working on antivirus products and you ask them about NSS, they will A, sort of twitch in their eye for a little while, and B, if you buy them a couple of beers and tell them you're not going to repeat it on, I don't know, a podcast, they will tell you quite how awful it is and what a terrible idea it is and what a scam it is and a lot more other things that we actually probably can't repeat. But yeah, really yeah. Not well regarded by the people who work on the products that they evaluated and, in many people's opinion, flat-out scam.
Yeah, look, I mean, we've got to be careful what we say, right? But a lot of vendors allege that NSS, you know, it is a pay-to-play thing, you know, and the friendlier you are with them, the better you do. They also say that their test scenarios don't look like anything that you're going to encounter in the real world. So it's all just a bit arbitrary. And yet, NSS reports tend to justify purchases for a lot of CISOs out there because it is always handy as a CISO to have a report in front of you to say, well, I bought it because, you know, look, here's a report from an independent testing company that says it's good. Now, I mean, I'm really curious for your thoughts on this because you actually do product testing for some of your clients. Not all clients can afford to have a team like Insomnia actually pull something apart and have a real look at it. But, you know, I mean, beyond what you hear, what are your thoughts on the sort of concept of what NSS does?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, having your products evaluated is a really important thing because someone purchasing in the security industry, you know, the quality of the products you're buying is by and large opaque, and the method by which they do their thing is opaque, or even worse, encumbered by intellectual property restrictions, so you can't even look at how it works. You're not allowed to reverse engineer it, you're not allowed to pull it apart and understand it. So you can really see why people would gravitate towards a sort of something like NSS Labs, a sort of a consumer report for these products, because you don't have the time or the expertise in most cases to look into these products, and retaining someone like us to look at it isn't that cheap. It is important to be able to evaluate these things, and you can see why people would go for something like NSS and trust their work, but it's just never as simple, and obviously once a vendor like NSS is entrenched in the way that they are, the temptation is, of course, to just milk it rather than necessarily doing the kind of work. And, going back to a vendor and telling them that their product sucks doesn't make you any friends with that vendor. And if those vendors are the source of your income, which, that's one half of NSS's business, then you're in quite a difficult place. I mean, where we do it, it's because we have mutual customers with the vendor who are paying us, and it kind of makes us not the target of the vendor's wrath, or at least we have no financial relationship with the vendor, so it doesn't matter if we piss them off. But that's just not the case for someone whose core business is doing that kind of eval.
Yeah. Look, I think you've pretty much summed it up nicely there, but, I have heard many times, I mean, they've been around for a long time, NSS. Do you know what I mean? And pretty much everyone says the same thing, which is if you want to know how useful something is for protecting networks or assets in the real world, NSS Labs reports aren't really going to tell you that. That's the most polite, non-defamatory way I can put it.
Yes, I concur with your non-defamatory statement. I'd like to assert that I also am not defaming anybody.
That's right. So, yeah. And, of course, the Streisand effect. Although I've got to say, CrowdStrike has mishandled this. I mean, there's no two ways about that. Going to the court, going crying to the court.
No.
Do you know what I mean? And asking for a TRO. I mean, come on, man. All you're going to do is, all you're going to do is wind up with headlines all over the place, which is exactly what's happened.
Yeah, I don't think it's been handled well on their side of the fence. But yeah, I feel that they have, pretty legitimate complaints.
Pretty legitimate complaints, but maybe not the best way to deal with them. Meanwhile, Yahoo, still in trouble with the United States government. This time, a bunch of US senators have written to them with a please explain. I think, I don't even know if we discussed it on the show, but I think the SEC has kind of cracked the shits with them as well for not disclosing it. So, You know, I mean, the fallout from Yahoo's two mega breaches is just continuing. So we're going to have to wait and see how it progresses, because you never know how dire this is going to get for some of the executives involved at the time.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, especially when, you know, we have seen, you know, a real interest, I think, on behalf of some bits of the US government to punish organizations. I mean, I'm thinking more of the consumer equipment vendors, the TP-Links and the Netgears and whoever's getting smacked by the FTC. The SEC obviously also has some teeth. And yeah, this absolutely, and with, you know, interest from the government as well, I guess this really could go wrong. And of course, the timing is awful when they're in the middle of, you know, trying to maybe get bought by Verizon, maybe not getting bought by Verizon. Who knows? It's just, yeah, it's bad for Yahoo, and I guess bad for their users. Well, it was bad for the users when they got breached anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So, look, we'll just keep an eye on that one and see how it progresses. Next story. Turning our attention to the United States of Trumpistan now. And, like, it's really good to have a skiff and all of that. It's really good to have secure facilities for, you know, planning your response to some sort of geopolitical crisis. Or you could do it in a restaurant like Donald Trump did. And not only that, but you could take the cell phones of aides who are around you and use the flashlights on them to point them at all of the secret documents so that you can read them right. What is it with these people and light switches? I've got to ask. You know what I mean?
I thought the same thing.
if his aides and all of his personal stuff, if their cell phones weren't already owned, they are now.
Well, yeah, exactly right. And then pointing their classified docs all over the place. You got to hope that they're at least, I don't know, like, they're not using some rubbish third-party flashlight app they got from some, you know, sideload of Android store.
Exactly right.
right, yeah. So, of course, yeah, Trump was eating dinner with Japanese Prime Minister when they got the news about North Korea's most recent missile test. There was a bunch of, you know, response that had to be planned. Aides showed up with the various documents describing what had happened. And, yes, rather than, like, leave the restaurant, Trump's, you know, resort where they're eating dinner, they just spread all their stuff around started working on it right in the middle of the restaurant whilst people are like live Facebooking this. There's some guy posted a selfie with the guy who carries the like nuclear launch code football whilst they're in the middle of, like, just what a ridiculous, what a debacle. Like, it's just the, like, Deep breath.
Now, some time ago, we actually spoke about the executive order, the draft that was circulating that we said looked, you know, pretty reasonable, but nothing really new or innovative or whatever. And, you know, it was expected that that was going to get signed. Now, the reason it hasn't been signed, apparently, is because there's been an extensive redrafting of that order. I've got a link to a story in this week's show notes from the Internet Governance Project. And, you know, they've taken a look at leaks of the second draft, and they say it's pretty comprehensive and looks quite well constructed. So, yeah, we'll have to see what happens there.
Yeah, it does seem surprising. I know he said this, I said this last time we talked about this, that it seemed on the, you know, the scale of Trump executive orders to be better than average, but
that's not exactly setting a high bar.
But no, this new draft that's been leaked is significantly more sensitive and has walked back some of the kind of slightly more rah-rah USA bits of the previous one. And yeah, it does look strangely sensible, I guess. Mm. It probably will never happen for that reason, which is
we'll wait for the third draft, right? That'll be the one. So
third
let's
draft
not get
just be
too
crayon
excited
with yet. A picture of a computer.
A bunch of activists in Qatar and Nepal are being, you know, they're being fished to hell and back, basically. And Amnesty International's released a report on that, according to Ars Technica.
Yeah, there's a report about this fishing campaign, which actually, if you remember back to Black Hat few years ago now, with the sort of Robin Sage social network phishing campaign project thing, it's actually quite similar to that, where there's a, you know, identities being created or an identity being created, social network profiles sort of maintained to make it look like it's a real person, and then contacts being made, you know, through mostly I think the Google Hangouts, linking people onwards to a fake Google login page, and actually quite a sophisticated one based on the report that would then steal your creds and onwards to, you know, ownage and jail and whatever else happens in prison in Qatar.
Now, ThreatPost is carrying a story here based on a report, you know, a typical sort of vendor report, and it's not exactly counterintuitive, but I think it's worth discussing in the wake of all of the DNC stuff and how utterly blown Russia became in its operations in the United States, you know, which eventually, you're thinking eventually that's going to blow back on them, right? So this report basically says that more and more governments are starting to outsource APT work and the actual collection phase, which is super interesting. And, you know, it's just one way to get a little bit more arm's length in terms of attribution and whatnot. It seems credible, this this report.
Yeah, certainly. And I think we've seen, you know, the assertions that the Chinese were using, you know, sort of third-party contractors or separate companies to do some of this work is a refrain we've seen made a few times over the years. And the idea that, you know, a country like Russia would use it for a bit more distance absolutely makes sense. The other aspect, I suppose, is if you're a country that's a bit smaller, doesn't necessarily have the capability in-house, being able to outsource it makes a lot of sense. And the report cites the UAE, you know, the Arab Emirates, as an example in that category, which, yeah, it would make sense that you would just buy that off the shelf from a, you know, a specialist provider rather than do it yourself and cock it up.
Mm. Now, look, this next story from Motherboard, I've got mixed feelings about it, right? Because basically a couple of guys came up with an ICS ransomware. And, you know, they're saying, oh, this could, you know, this could happen. Look, we've seen researchers come up with all sorts of stuff that really is not going to exist in the wild. We know that ICS systems are quite vulnerable, but we also know that dropping ransomware that affects ICS in the real world is a great way to get drone struck. Do you know what I mean? So I'm a little bit skeptical if we're going to see this anytime soon. What are your thoughts on this, Adam?
Yeah, I'm also skeptical. I mean, this is the sort of kind of fluff security academic research that makes me a bit cranky, because it's just a case of, it would be cool if we could like get some ICS gear and kind of tinker with it and what can we do and write a rubbish
paper. But I mean, it's just like really the reports of, hey, we've come up with proof of concept ransomware for thermostats, or we've come up with proof of concept ransomware for cars. You know what I mean? It's just the same sort of thing. And I feel like, you know, Motherboard here is sort of saying, oh, you know, look out, this could happen. And it's like, well, yeah, you know, a lot of things could happen. You know, I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. You know, my partner was down at the beach today and $65 flew into her face, like just on the breeze, right? Lots of things can happen, but I don't know that this is one of them.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I mean, it's obvious to anyone skilled in the art that this is, you know, from an engineering perspective, that this is possible. And it doesn't need to be actually done, made a, you know, made a story out of until it actually happens for actual real.
Yeah. That would be news. This, not so much. Sorry to say. Sorry to say. Mac malware apparently getting some word macroviruses. It's good they've joined the club. This is exciting.
Yeah, they're doing it, you know, classic Windows style. There's been some word malicious word documents observed in the wild, which have macros. And then rather than, you know, using VB like the macros do on Windows, they're using bits of actually the Python Empire framework, which is an exploit framework, open source exploit framework for Macs. It drops that and then does the usual sorts of things, pulls in a second stage loader and provides a bunch of other capabilities onwards from there, you know, taking screenshots, stealing your files, pivoting through you, all that kind of good stuff. But yes, Mac users, don't run macros on your Mac.
Mm. Now, look, something that we've spoken about, that we've mentioned, you know, countless times on this show, is if you want to get data off an iPhone, just attack the computer it syncs to, right? And this, the Russian government appears to have learned this X agent, which is the same, you know, Trojan or malware family that affected the DNC last year. There's a version going around for Mac, and one of the things that it does is it exfiltrates iPhone backups, you know, steals passwords, grabs screenshots, all that good stuff. So, yeah, not exactly safe from the Russians when you are using a Mac.
Yes, apparently this particular tooling does seem to be attributed to the same, the Fancy Bear group, also Pornstorm, which is an unfortunate name for a group. So, yeah, the same people that have been attributed to the DNC. And, of course, yeah, seeing this capability rolling out to Macs, I guess, is a, you know, validation of the increased market share that Apple has.
Bad time to be running a WordPress blog. But then again, when is a good time to be running a WordPress blog? Apparently there's some, you know, attack going around, some mass defacement attack going around that I think is affecting up to 2 million pages. And then, you know, what comes after that, who knows? I mean, I'm predicting eventually we're going to see like a Mirai style botnet made of millions of WordPress hosts. That's got to be coming real soon.
Yeah, well, I guess once we see a WordPress bug that's suitable for that kind of worm propagation, then yeah, we might get it. And certainly the scale of this one, you know, would be a good example of that. I mean, having 2 million web servers is going to be a pretty useful bot. And I'm surprised actually that it has been, you know, just used for a simple defacement, unless that's a cover for building longer term access to the boxes. But it seems kind of dumb,
dude. If you were going to build longer term access to the boxes, you wouldn't deface them. You know what I mean? Update the code, and that would be that, right? And notice, you know, it's just amazing to me that there's this whole secondary industry around securing WordPress blogs. There's what are they, Securi are one of them, and WordFence, who've actually come on board as a Risky Business sponsor. So we'll be talking to them, I think in a few weeks about their stuff. But you know, WordPress is so bad that it's at least providing employment somewhere, right?
I mean, it's not as bad as it used to be. I mean, I think given the amount of WordPress blogs there are and the amount they get owned, I mean, it's, you know, it's less bad than it used to be. But yeah, it's just...
Turning our attention back to motherboard again, and apparently Phineas Fisher is, quote, taking a break because of stress. So Phineas Fisher is on stress leave. Probably could have something to do with some crew getting arrested. Spanish police, of course, claimed that they made some arrests connected to Phineas Fisher. The Phineas Fisher persona in contact with Vice has said, hey, you know, they're nothing to do with us. But that's of course, what they would say, right?
Yeah, I mean, the excuse, I guess, that Phineas Fisher is using here is that the people who've been picked up in Spain were people whom Phineas Fisher was proxying through to carry out the attacks on the Catalan local police a while ago. And that doesn't, I mean, given the backgrounds of some of the people that, of the three people that were arrested, who kind of sounded like they were sort of, you know, plausibly security scene hacking sort of people. Mm. I don't know, that rings super true.
That's a hell of a coincidence, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's not implausible. I mean, people on hacker channels get tricked into running stuff that they shouldn't all the time. So maybe Phineas Fisher socialed them into running proxies, but why not just use everybody else rather than them? Anyway, so yeah, that bit doesn't ring super true. Phineas Fisher says that the kind of pressure of all of having to maintain the OPSEC required is kind of getting to him or her. Or the group, as it may be.
Yeah.
And that they're going to take a break for a while and think about it, but carry on hacking perhaps under a different persona that's less risky, which, you know, that sounds like smart OPSEC.
Yeah, although, I don't know, man, just going to talk to Vice about it.
It's maybe like, not so much.
Well, yeah, exactly, right? It's like, okay, if these arrests had nothing to do with you, like, why are you still out there talking about it? You've already popped up previously and said, hey, I'm still okay, it's not me. You know, they're still trying to move the needle, which just tends to suggest to me, it tends to indicate to me, that it's more likely that the people who were arrested were part of some group, that we know as Phineas Fisher. So I don't know, man. It's maybe we'll know in time, maybe we won't. Let's just see. Ars Technica is carrying a for this week in Creepy, Ars Technica is carrying a story about basically fingerprinting people through browsers, but fingerprinting the OS instead of the browser, so that if someone's using multiple browsers, they can still basically, you know, tie them together and track them. This fingerprinting stuff is getting pretty good, and it's creepy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, some of their results are very, very good, like 90-something percent across browsers, which I think is the key issue here. So, like, yeah, last week we talked about adding more web support for kind of low-level graphics rendering primitives. You know, exposing that level of hardware access does give this kind of cross-platform and sort of cross-browser fingerprinting, a bunch of extra stuff to use to fingerprint. And that's the kind of thing that they're looking at here, you know, the configuration of your audio, the configuration of your graphics or your fonts or that kind of thing that are shared across browsers. And yeah, it's creepy as hell.
Oh, Alec Muffet, who was on the show just a few weeks ago, and I've been watching him over Twitter and Facebook working on this thing for a while. He's basically written a new tool that quickly spins up hidden services, and it looks pretty cool.
Yeah, so it's a kind of collection of tools that will allow you to take an existing website that's on the internet and then expose it via Tor as a hidden service, and it takes care of some of the plumbing and the sort of setting up the sort of proxy in the middle and the onion addresses and the, you know, kind of URL routing and some glue to help with doing cert auth across the top of that if you're going to buy a cert for your onion, if you'd like to do that. So yeah, if you are looking to deploy onion services quickly without necessarily having to go into all the fiddly detail, which, you know, if you're going to run a drug market on the Tor network, maybe you should focus on the fiddly detail a little bit. But for everyone else, it's kind of a good place to start playing with this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I like Onion Share as well when you just got to like swap some files via hidden service. I mean, that works really well. But, you know, this is just another handy tool. Just wanted to quickly mention Sophos has bought Invincia, which is one of those machine learning-based anti-malware plays. So that's kind of interesting. It looks like the machine learning approach has been validated. And I'm expecting that, you know how every year RSA has a theme? I'm guessing this year, you know, instead of being Derpa Derpa DLP or Derpa Derpa this or Derpa Derpa that, it's going to be Derpa Derpa machine learning. I can just feel it in my bones.
Yeah, although, probably right. Yeah. Emphasis on the Derpa Derpa Derp.
Now, of course, one thing that's been confusing the crap out of me is everyone's going berserk with these stories about how US Customs can, like, grab your phone and ask for the password. And I think it's all sort of caught up in the anti-Trump stuff. But, of course, this isn't a new issue, but it has led to a spate of new OPSEC guides springing up about how you should roll in and out of a country to keep your data safe. And it's just like, you know, some good advice, but a lot of bad advice as well going around.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, this kind of thing has been happening when people have been crossing the borders, not just in the US and not just, in more oppressive countries. It is a thing that happens, in the rest of the world, Australia and New Zealand as well. But yeah, a lot of the advice, as you say, really not necessarily, I mean, some of it's is good but not practical, and some of it's bad and you shouldn't do it, and some of it is vaguely sensible, like just leave your stuff at home and don't take it with you, which not so bad. But a lot of sort of armchair cypherpunk kind of we'll just do this and this and this, and then that will be foolproof, when in fact when you're being yelled at by a customs guy, it's very different.
Yes, it is. Look, a tool release here. Uber has released one of its internal tools that actually looks quite useful. They've built like a CA for SSH for internal use, and they've got another tool that they've just released which helps with continuous reauthentication of SSH keys. Does this look like something you'd use?
Yeah, so I mean, SSH has had key and certificate based auth for a long time, but it hasn't ever really, well, I mean, there have been some add-ons, I suppose, but there haven't really been a way to use it in a, PKI structure, in a centralized PKI structure with the sort of revocation and, regular reissuing of keys that we have in the X509, TLS world. Whether or not that's a thing that you want is another question, but certainly Uber are using it internally and have released their implementation of both the CA kind of issuing side and the authentication PAM module that would implement it on the server side where you are authenticating. So yeah, it's certainly worth looking into if you do manage a large fleet of Unix systems with particular set of access requirements where a PKI structure would help you. There are some cases where that is particularly useful. For example, validation of SSH host keys when you log into boxes that are spun up very quickly without that you don't log into regularly. So yeah, there are some use cases where it could be very useful. I think those are the ones that probably have driven Uber towards this kind of model.
Well, good on them for releasing it to the public. That's absolutely nice. Yes. It's always good when these Silicon Valley companies take tools and spin them out. Well, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us. And of course, we will chat to you again next week.
Thanks very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now, and we are taking a look at a new type of event, or at least as far as I know, it's a new type of event, that got its debut here in Australia last year. PlatypusCon was held in Sydney in September last year, and the idea was to hold a different type of conference. Instead of speakers just delivering content to an audience, the idea was every single session would be an interactive workshop. Attendees were given a list of tools to put on their laptops before they came, and everyone had to participate. So it was a cross between a training event and workshops and a conference. And as far as I can tell, it's not something that I've seen happen elsewhere in the security industry. There might be some events like this, but I am certainly not aware of them. The Platypus crew are planning another event this year, a two-day hacker camp in the Australian bush. But this is an event concept that I think needs to go mainstream. It's got all of the networking benefits of a conference combined with an emphasis on workshops and training. It's just a really great idea for a technical event. PlatypusCon organisers Snail and Lynn S. join me via Skype for this interview. Snail is the lady's voice and Lynn S. is the gentleman. I asked them to tell me in their own words what PlatypusCon was all about, and here's what they had to say.
PlatypusCon is for 2016 was a full day of workshops, getting real hands-on. So we wanted to see something different from traditional speakers just talking to the audience and more create a high participatory environment where we can all help each other learn things and grow together.
This came from your typical after community event kind of drinking session. We're all sitting there complaining about the information security community. And what we've seen, especially in Sydney where we are, is that there is definitely a whole lot of one, recycled content, but two, a lot of content where you, and you know, this happens in events. So you go there and then someone talks at you for an hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever. And then you go home and then you go drinking, not really having, I think, taken away like the full extent of what should be coming out of these events. So we got together and we said, how about we build something that's focused entirely on practical participation? So the original name, which was Let's Just Hack Shit, was founded. It was built around that idea. And as it kind of grew, and I think it grew faster than any of us expected, we got together and we said, hey, you know what? We're in a good place now. Let's do a con. Like, we have amazing people. We've brought these, amazing people from all over the place together. Let's get together for a day and see if we can expand upon the concept and do a full day of just high participation, not talks, but all workshops. So that's where Platypus Con came from.
It's an interesting idea. And when I first sort of heard about it, I thought, I was kind of surprised no one's done it before, right? Because it's not really a con, is it? And it's not really a training event. It's sort of somewhere in between, because it's sort of peer-to-peer. A lot of it would be peer-to-peer learning. I'd imagine people in these sessions are helping each other out, that sort of thing. Yep. And the focus is sort of on collective learning. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. So during the con itself, we tried to kind of enforce that, please participate feel. By having no traditional talks except for the introduction and a few, what we call the fireball talks at the ending, the lightning talks typically. And all it was is a full day of four streams of two-hour workshops where everyone's expected to please bring a laptop and please have installed the following tools. I think the most surprising thing for us is that we actually offered free booze to everyone for the whole day. And not only did we not have any people get drunk and make a real embarrassment out of themselves, but everyone that we saw sat down, got their laptops out, and participated in workshops for the whole day. And we were packed right until the end.
And what sort of workshops did you actually host? What level of skills were you pitching these things at? Were they for very specific things? Were they, you tell me, because I got no idea.
I think we targeted our workshops at quite a range of skill levels and also quite a range of interests, which I think was a good decision. Our workshops varied from things like a software-defined radio to hacking drones, which was really popular and took up almost a full stream by itself. We also had things about, for example, lessons learned from 1 year of Capture the Flag competitions. So we as Platypus also run a Capture the Flag team. We regularly participate. And we also had some really cool talks. So, for example, we had one on Red Star OS.
I think I know who did that
yep.
one.
Our dear mutual friend.
Yes.
We also had some really interesting stuff on like fuzzing with AFL, iOS content, pen testing, enterprise networks. So I think it was really targeted at a really broad range of skill sets. I'd like to think that, out of all the people that came, we would have gotten a broad range of skills. I think it worked. Like, by some manner of miracle, it seems to have worked. Like,
and you pulled a pretty decent crowd for the first one, didn't you?
We did. We were not expecting that many. I thought, what was the original hard cap?
We started out at 75 and then, increased to 100, then 120, and then 150, and I think we're pretty much close to 200.
And this year, well, what's the goal for this year? Are you expecting, it picked up plenty of feedback, right? I couldn't make it at the time, but I heard everyone just tell me how good it was. So I'm imagining you're expecting a bigger number this year.
We're currently in the process of scoping out locations, and also we're going to start not the call for papers, more like a call for content I think we're going to try and be even more flexible this year in terms of what kind of content that we bring. I think it's really cool to let people kind of showcase the cool skills and even stuff that like perhaps is not typically presented at cons, because of, you know, format or whatever. So for example, the drone hacking stuff, I think enabling that is really cool. And, you know, let's look to have more of that stuff this year. Fair.
Now, why is it, do you think, that this type of event, why is it, do you think, that it took a couple of people in Sydney, you know, which is a long way from the epicenter of the industry, to actually have this idea, especially when training, traditional training, is just so very expensive? Why do you think that is, that no one's done this before?
One big contributor to our success when we initially started this off, and this was absolutely crucial, was that we regularly got together. And we did, for example, capture the flags, workshops, yada, yada, yada. And that takes an immense amount of effort. I think anyone can kind of start this, like anyone can kind of think along the same lines, make a website and like make a logo, not as great as Snail's artwork, but anyone can start this kind of thing, but not everyone is willing to kind of, or sees the need to put in time behind it and push, like constantly push for interesting, engaging content. And at the same time, keeping in mind the need not to like leave people behind. I think sometimes that happens. Like if you're doing really, you know, really specialized stuff, it can be difficult for people to feel involved. I think keeping that in mind is also important.
Well, yeah, we were a community first and foremost. And by being that first, we kind of had the backing to do cool stuff, and everyone with us wanted to do cool stuff with us.
So how much did PlatypusCon actually cost last year?
It cost $75, or $50 if you were a student.
Yeah, now I look at training budgets, you know, and I look at what people spend on training, and I'm thinking for a lot of American, you know, companies, they might see something, some workshop coming up at PlatypusCon, and it would be cheaper for them to fly their people to Australia to participate in your workshops than actually pay training companies in the United States.
I think that's great. When we got together and to build a PlatypusCon, what we realized is by kind of pooling our resources a bit, we could achieve more than what any of us individually could have otherwise achieved. One of the things we said, and I think we still hold pretty dear to our hearts, is that it is our role as kind of as organizers of this to enable this kind of content where we can to keep this stuff cheap for the participants. Like, you know, $75 to some people, that's like, yeah, $75, whatever, here you go. To some people, that's a lot of money. And I think it's the right thing to do whatever we can to help these people get exposed to this content. These people are not only the future of our industry, but they probably have some really cool ideas of their own. They just don't have a place to share it. So let's get them out here. You know, let's get them to meet other people.
I remember as a student missing watching Parliament do a 3.5 hour performance at the Metro nightclub in Melbourne because I couldn't afford the tickets and they were only about $60. It's one of my greatest regrets in life. So yes, it can be quite a bit of money for people who don't have the cash. But what was the mix of attendees? Because I know that there were plenty of professionals who were there. It wasn't just students. What was the mix like?
A lot of students, a lot of professionals just from the community, a lot of enthusiasts, and those who wanted to get in the industry.
And what sort of stuff are we likely to see at this year's event? What's on the agenda? What's on the syllabus, Snail?
Well, I know, I think Linus was pretty excited about the drone stuff that we have for our 2-day camp. But for me, I think probably the most exciting part would probably be SDR. So you can't really play with software-defined radio much in the outside without getting into a bit of trouble. But going somewhere where there's basically no reception, there's a lot you can do.
But in addition to SDR and drone stuff, is there going to be any sort of traditional enterprise level, you know, security skills workshops that people could attend?
So our call for content is not complete. We are still looking for people to come present. I'm going to go on a limb and assume that, yes, there will be that kind of content, but people should expect it to, again, be participation focused. So it's not just, you know, someone standing up the front and going, hey, let's talk about this protocol. Look at this speak up I did. It'll be more, hey, let's bring your laptop. You know, perhaps here's a file or here's a device you can have a look at on a network.
Or here, I'm throwing something out on the network now. Get your own PCAPs.
Right. Exactly. but on that subject of enterprise, I think we have a few special surprises for people who are intending to participate in the Capture the Flag competition for this year. We really took a look at it and we took some feedback from the last Capture the Flag. And I think, and also because we compete in a fair bit in just like regular CTFs, I think there's a lot of room to kind of, I don't know, make some of the challenges more relevant to people who might work in InfoSec on a day-to-day basis. So I think I won't spoil the secret, but I think for the people at least who are going to play the CTF, they're going to enjoy it.
All right. Well, we'll just have to wait until the cloak of mystery has been ripped away. Linus Snail, thank you very much for joining me on the show to have a bit of a chat about PlatypusCon.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Linus and Snail there talking about PlatypusCon. Thanks to them for their time. We only use pseudonyms in that interview because they both have pretty square jobs, and that was just a simple way of doing it. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now, and this week's show is brought to you by Vericode. Big thanks to them. Vericode, I'm sure you know, but if you don't, Vericode makes cloud-based static analysis tools for securing software. But they're really mixing things up at the moment, gearing their newer products towards development teams instead of security teams. The company recently did a survey that made for some pretty happy reading, actually. It turns out that writing secure code is something developers are increasingly seeing as a vital and core part of their job. They're often turning to open source tools during the development phase to do some basic static analysis, and they're really genuinely into this idea of writing, you know, secure, good software. And often you'll find their KPIs are even geared towards it, and that's the carrot angle, but there is a stick angle as well. Our next guest, Vericode's Product Innovation Manager, Colin Dominey, has a background in development in financial services environments, and he's really seen some interesting trends while working in the trenches. Depending on the industry and the environment, some developers are actually now penalized for letting bad bugs slip through. They can lose their bonuses, not meet their KPIs, sometimes they can even lose their jobs. At least in financial services, there is a real secure development culture taking root. It's a substantial enough trend that Vericode has actually released a new code scanning tool geared towards developers. It's a scanner that integrates into IDEs. Colin joined me to talk about the carrot and the stick, the changing role of static analysis in a world gone DevOps crazy, and Vericode's recent survey. Here he is.
The stick is definitely, in regulated environments, if there's a root cause analysis and it's traced back to basic application hygiene, there's an audit trail, somebody's going to lose their job, or a vendor is going to lose their contract, something bad is going to happen. There's a very definite negative consequence to that. I think the carrot, incentivizes a couple of ways to do this. One is developers like, they kind of do like tooling. They like being able to measure stuff. They like being able to measure one against the other, their own career progression, being able to give them tooling, to be able to give them metrics, things that they can measure in dashboard, integrations that they can have that show that they're doing the right thing, that they're producing a quality product. I think those are kind of things that gel well with the developer mindset.
So it's really about just, you know, the motivation is they just want to do a better job.
I think so, and I think I'm a believer that security is a proxy to code quality. It's quite a
well, and
topic.
Network quality, and you know, operational quality, and I mean that's the mantra, isn't it? That you know, yeah, you do things the right way, and they generally wind up being more secure.
Yeah, I mean the kind of things that I've seen in real life. You know, I've had a couple of years of reviewing. I probably reviewed 500,000 coding flaws. Thereabouts, over a couple of years, you know, these are things that you're very surprised that people are doing these type of things. The basic lack of hygiene, and you've got to think if people are making that sort of basic coding error, how they're dealing with more complex issues like the business logic of the application. And I think there's a very definite proxy. I think that, that applications that probably show poor security characteristics probably really aren't up to scratch as far as their business function goes as well. And we actually use that. We use that as a bit of a proxy to then go back to business and say, your application is performing or assessing very poorly on the security scale. Maybe you want to have a look at some of the business logic behind that.
Now, you know, we've spoken about other surveys on the show before that have found that, you know, security and development teams are naturally, you know, quite siloed, and that the people are, you know, at a higher level within organizations isn't really trying to do much to connect them, even though we're going into this DevOps-y sort of world. But recent findings, you know, you guys did a survey of 350 developers and 150 development managers, and, you know, asked a different set of questions, and there's stuff to feel optimistic about. Primarily, it seems like there's just this groundswell in development teams, you know, wanting to, you know, really wanting to become security aware and get their hands dirty, which is great news. What did this survey actually find?
So the survey found that preventing data breaches and cyber attacks is one of the developers' main concerns. I think there's a perception, and maybe a negative one, that developers are only concerned about features and getting product to market. And I think that's changing. So the, you know, Vericode surveyed 350 developers and 150 dev managers. And they said that 37% of those respondents were actually concerned about preventing data breaches. I'm aware of this. You know, my job previously in an investment bank, that was a major concern. Our application teams were very aware that they were going to be attacked and that they could be breached and that they would have very negative consequences. So I think it's unfair to say that developers aren't concerned about security. I think that is changing.
I mean, 37% actually said it was their number one concern. 23% said meeting customer or regulatory compliance was their top challenge. And here's where we get into that sort of stereotypical view. 21% said it's about meeting budget and delivery schedules, but about 20% said delivering secure code to pass internal audits was their number one objective. So it does seem the care factor is definitely on the up. You've also got some other findings here. More and more developers are testing, like, very early in the development cycle?
Yeah, I think this is a characteristic of the fact that a lot of the development tools have, the security tools have matured and become more usable for developers. I think there used to be a negative perception amongst developers that they didn't want to be testing in the development phase because the tools were going to slow them down. I think the tools are getting better. I think the survey found that up to 40% of people are doing some testing and development stage. And obviously, developers are aware that if they're working on a project and then they get shifted off the project, then they've got to come down later in the life cycle and come back and do a context switch and then come and do floor fixing. In a panic stage, it's going to be a negative impact on them, and it's going to be much more costly. You know, the numbers indicate it's 30 times more expensive to fix in production than it is in development. And I've certainly seen that in practice. You know, I've seen the very real cost of having to put a crisis team onto an app and fix it in production. It's far more cost-effective to do that in development.
And yeah, you know, I mean, some of the findings are indeed obvious. Like, I think one of the top five takeaways here is that developers worry that security testing slows them down. I think, you know, there's absolutely no surprise there. Sensitive data exposure is the most concerning vulnerability. Again, not so surprising. But number five, secure DevOps is the future. It's almost like there's this cultural shift happening. And look, I think it's something that everyone's been aiming for a long time, but it does sort of seem like it's upon us now that there's, I mean, look, last year I did a survey of my audience and I found that something like 20-25% of the audience of this podcast are actually developers, right? That's just, you know, it just really doesn't vibe with our stereotypical view of developers, does it?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, I think developers are leading the charge. I think the secure DevOps movement, I think it's a very exciting place for security practitioners to be involved. And I think it's going to be a challenge for security people because devs are leading the way, the developers are leading the way here. And if security and security vendors and security professionals don't play catch up and come to the game, they really are going to get left behind.
You know, I actually really do agree with you on that. I think AppSec is going to become such a big deal, you know, even more so than it is already. And, you know, people have got to get with the program, and insert themselves into that development program specifically. Now, Vericode has just pumped out a major release, I believe, in order to address a lot of these concerns, like help developers assess stuff like early in the development, actually in their IDEs. Is that right?
That is correct. You know, the third finding in the survey was that developers worry that security testing slows them down. Now, Vericode has released a new product, which is called Greenlight. And this is a product that integrates directly into the developer's IDE. There's an Eclipse version of this product that does Java security assessment. Literally, while the developer is typing their code, they can do a security assessment of the code that they're currently working on right within that IDE. They can do a full security scan on that piece of code using the Vericode static scan engine. This has had 3 trillion lines of code. It's had 10 years of development. It's probably the best static code engine that exists. They can utilize that right within their IDE, and they can get results in almost real time, typically a handful of seconds.
So I'm really curious how that works, right? So I imagine this is some sort of IDE plugin, right? But does that send the code off to you? Because, you know, Vericode is very well known for having embraced the software as a service thing quite early on. So do you push a button and it zaps it up to your servers, crunches it and sends it back? Or is it actually, are you actually doing desktop static analysis now?
It's using the cloud, but just to alleviate the concern that people would have that we're pushing the source into the cloud, it's doing a compilation. It's doing their standard Eclipse Java build. It's taking the compiled file and doing a scan in the cloud. So you're using the key point here really is that you're using exactly the same scanning engine as you would if you were doing a full application scale static analysis. And I think my practical experience indicates this is quite important to developers. What developers don't like is being surprised. They don't like to be working in their local environments, doing local scans, doing local testing, doing local integration tests, and then push to release and then discover that somewhere along the line, their security organization is going to come along and do a different set of assessments. And I think this is really where Greenlight is going to be quite a game changer. It's the same scanning engine that the security folk would be using.
Okay, right. So I get it. So you would have had developers who are using whatever tool, and then it's been the security teams using Vericode and then coming back and whacking them with the stick we were talking about earlier.
Correct.
That's interesting, right? Because it almost seems like, and I've spoken to other companies in this space, right? And it seems like all of them are finally selling their products to the people who really should have been buying them all along, which is the developers. It's like this used to be a security team purchase and now it's becoming a development team purchase. Is that actually right?
I think it's going to show. Look, I think what happens is the developers know that they're going to be doing security, being security tested in any case. So what they would have been doing is they would have been using a number of open source tools, alternate vendors. They would have been trying different ingenious, often open source. And that's why there's a lot of reasonably credible open source tools available that developers utilize. But the fact is that these aren't the ones that traditionally have the hallmark and pedigree that a security team would be happy to use. So I think there's always been that disconnect. And there's often a lot of friction around that security team going to the development team and saying, you know, we found something that you haven't found.
But have you noticed a shift in where the purchase orders are coming from?
Developers are definitely becoming greater influencers, and obviously we'd hope, Vericode would hope that, you know, we're going to be able to provide developers with a tool that they'll be happy with. They will have an increasing level of influence in their purchasing decision. It's simply getting earlier in the chain. The product's only been available in the last couple of weeks, but I would predict that, certainly my experience when the previous program that I was running at an investment bank, we had to get buy-in from developers and development leads. You know, when I was choosing the tooling that we were going to use, they wanted to make sure that the tools we chose had, you know, good low false positives, that the results were actionable. These things are important because you're putting workload on the development team. If we can give them something that they're going to be comfortable with, and they can use in the native environments, I think everybody's going to win.
It's just interesting, isn't it, that companies making software, you know, code checking tools have traditionally sold to security teams, not development teams. It's just interesting that was ever a thing. You know what I mean?
Indeed, I agree. I mean, I have a development background, and you know, I think in my time I would have loved to have been able to use these kind of tools. But yeah, traditionally those would have been in the hands of the security people.
All right. Well, Colin Dominey, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a bit of a chat about Vericode survey findings and to discuss the logic of your latest product release. Cheers.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
That was Colin Dominey of Vericode there with this week's sponsor interview. Go check out their new stuff, Vericode Green Light. I have linked to it in this week's show notes. Big thanks to Vericode for its sponsorship of this week's show. And that is nearly it for this week's episode. But before we go, of course, it is time for what has become a favourite segment among many of the listeners out there in listener land. It is Story Corner with Jake Davis. And this week I present to you the final story in his three-part trilogy, Playing Board Games with McAfee Antivirus founder John McAfee. I do hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
You know, I think my most vivid memory of John McAfee, and also my last, because this was the last time I met him, and again, he'll deny that we've ever met, but it was in his shed. Now, I don't know where the shed was, because he insisted I had a bag over my head before I was transported to the shed, but it was lovely once I was in there. There was a roaring fireplace and a wooden table, and McAfee Antivirus was nowhere to be seen, which I was pleased with, and so was he. And John said, "Jake, would you like to play one final board game?" And I said yes. You know, the Scrabble was strange. It really, really was. But guess who? Strange, but in a rousing sort of way. So he took out Monopoly. Now, I like Monopoly. I'm a big fan of Monopoly. We started, you know, he wanted to be the boot. I said, "Okay, John, you can be the boot, and I'll be the top hat." So we started playing, and as you can imagine, he'd replaced the money with Bitcoin. It wasn't that weird. You collected a Bitcoin as you passed Go, and he had a live Bitcoin ticker next to the game. And as the Bitcoin value in real life changed, so did the Bitcoin value in our game of Monopoly. I'd seen many sides to John at this point, so this was tame. So we were getting going, and this was the US Monopoly still, and I was doing okay. I had some houses up on Oriental Avenue, Vermont Avenue, you know. I had the light blue set down, and he picked up a chance card, one of the question mark cards, the orange ones, and looked at it, and he threw it onto the fireplace. It burned up, and he just scattered my houses. He just dashed them to one side. I said, "John, why'd you do that? What's the crack?" And he said, I just got an O-Day. A chance card was an O-Day for your hotels, for your houses, on Vermont and Oriental Avenue." I said, let me see the card." He said, I can't see the card. No one can. It's in the fire. It's gone. It's an O-Day. Like that. It's gone." I said, "Okay, John. Fair enough." So I ran out of houses. So we played a bit more. I was doing okay, given the fact that these O-Days kept flying at me, wrecking my real estate. And I picked up my own chance card. This one says CP/dev/null bank.csv. And I thought, I'm targeting John with that. So I did. And his face went red, his eyes started to widen. He just picked up his bank stash, his stash of Monopoly notes, threw them on the fireplace, said, "Well done, Jake, worthy play." Then he demanded that I go to jail because I had accessed his systems and wiped his wife's bank account. And I said, "Fine, what do you need to get out of jail? Is it like, do you need to roll like 2 sixes, 2 fives, what is it?" And he said I had to roll 3 sixes with a random number generator. And I couldn't roll 3 sixes with a random number generator for a very long time. by which point he'd monopolized most of the board. He didn't just put houses and hotels down. You know, he started putting down, like, server rooms, and he had, like, data centers on Park Place and Boardwalk. Apparently, those could mine Bitcoin by the second, even if no one's paying any rent. So, I questioned this, and I said, John, I can't beat you at anything, can I? It's impossible. These games are rigged, and I'm surprised anyone comes to your establishment and sits down with you and takes you seriously. Because this just isn't on. And he picked up the game, folded the board in half, threw it onto the fire, watched it burn, watched it all burn down, and just said, Jake, you have overstayed your welcome in my shed. Leave now. And I got up and I walked away. And that was the last time I saw John. Yeah, tough times.